Good morning, and welcome to Live Dharma Sunday. If you have called in to listen to this morning's broadcast, please note that all lines have been placed on mute to avoid background interference. If you are joining us from either the Bright Dawn Ning site or the Blog Talk Radio site, please note that it is not necessary to call in. If you're experiencing loss of audio or the Blog Talk Radio player is not working properly, please refresh your page and hit the play button once more. It may take a few moments for your browser to complete the buffering process. Once again, welcome to Live Dharma Sunday and enjoy the broadcast.
Welcome, everyone, to Sunday Morning Live, Dharmaha. This is Reverend Koyo Kobosi here. And I have to chuckle because, you know, this Blog Talk Radio and service we're using has a lot of benefits, but sometimes the procedure, getting on, starting it up, changes or it doesn't seem to work smoothly. Like this morning, we're calling into Skype. We go through Skype and to get the switchboard live, and it says it's trying because the clock is going, you know, and we wait about 2-3 minutes. Clock is still ticking and it's not connecting. So we end the call and we try again. And then Adrian and I says, well, why don't you call in with the regular number, not through Skype? And I try to call in there, and then that Blog Talk Radio voice says, you already have a host. You can't have two hosts. Oh, what? What's going on? And our guest is kind of worried, probably. He was trying to phone us by calling us on our cell phone. And so it was kind of hectic. And finally, we got it on, and then we hit the intro music, and it's so peaceful music. Such a contrast from the pre-show hecticness. And then we hear that nice, serene, meditative music. Isn't that how life is? Now, our lay ministers have been having an interesting discussion the last week or so. We're preparing a lay minister's handbook, and this is, you know, from the ground floor, so we're taking input. And one topic was prayer. Is there prayer in Buddhism? Is there such a thing as Buddhist prayer? You know, when you... Religion and religious practices always occur in some context, in a cultural, societal context, in a certain social context. Is it in an interfaith context? Is it just one-to-one with another person or just by yourself? There's some situation. And how does prayer fit into this? If you look at the wider situation of, let's say, you know, where the religious majority in America, it comes from the background in which that word is quite ubiquitous and all over. Are we doing a disservice in some way when we say no, we don't, there's no prayer in Buddhism, or we don't use that word, or is it, or is it misleading if we do use it and the impression is, prayer is the thing. And of course, different religions, they pray to, we pray to God or Jesus, and they pray to Buddha, and are we perpetuating that kind of notion in terms of public education and PR and so forth? And so there's been a lively discussion, sort of a chat among the lay ministers on their views about prayer. And maybe there's no simple answer. Sometimes prayer is used as a generic term for worship. So let's pray. Let's have a prayer meeting, or let's pray together, or at a interfaith function, they'll say, we're rotating the opening prayer. It's the Buddha's turn. So could you lead us in prayer? And it's not the right occasion for you to, what are you going to say? You have to be prepared. Or prayer, sometimes in addition to being used as a generic term for worship or doing some kind of religious practice, petitionary prayer, where this is prayer to God or to some higher power, asking for help. And what do you feel like if in a Buddhist context you say, I want a Mercedes Benz, or, quite often, sometimes you're talking about a human situation that transcends a religious situation, where regardless of the person's religious background, let's say a loved one is dying, and it quite often that person who may not be a real devout, I mean, he's raised in a certain religious background. It's not uncommon for this person later on to be saying, well, when this happened and my father was dying over it, and so forth, I prayed to every God there was. I didn't care if it was, that he would make it. You find that kind of situation where you know that it's about a human situation, not really a religious situation. I remember participating in a workshop with Presbyterian ministers. It was an interfaith workshop, and we were paired with, each pair had a different religious participant. I was paired with a Protestant lady, and the workshop setup was, okay, let's pretend that you're on an airplane and the airplane is going down. What do you do? What would you do as a practitioner of your faith? See, faith too is another word that's used in the same kind of way, generic, or perhaps faith in something, or, what is your faith tradition? See, it's a very common word. So we had an interesting discussion anyway at that workshop. What would you do if you were in a very emergency situation? And of course, we got sidetracked in one part of the discussion. We got sidetracked because supposing I, as a Buddhist minister, sitting there, there's two things going on. One is myself, and the other is helping other people. Supposing that my passenger next to me was a devout Christian and was asking for help, Maybe she said she knew we had been talking and she knew I was a minister. It didn't matter to her what kind of minister I was. She's grabbing my arm and saying, pray, let's pray, help me. You know, would you say, you know, as a Buddhist minister, this is a human situation, not a religious one. And I'll pray with that woman. If she's yelling out for Jesus, I'm not going to say, hey, we don't do that, you know, and blah, blah. Huh? Okay. The last thing that I remember on this topic was one time, it was summertime some years ago, and there was a family, and we got a telephone call. It was about 11 o'clock. It was about 9 o'clock in the evening, and I just happened to be at the church. The group was doing some kind of a taiko drumming practice, perhaps, and the phone rang. Sometimes our phone doesn't go to the minister, you know, be forwarded automatically. And this phone might have been unanswered. But I just happened to be there, and it was a family in Milwaukee, which was about an hour and a half drive from Chicago. And I didn't know this person, but this person said they had a friend whose father was in the hospital in Milwaukee. They're from Hawaii. And he came from Hawaii for a special heart operation that the specialist was in this hospital. And he's on life support now. And the family flew in. And, you know, he's terminal, and they're going to have to take him off life support and make that decision in the next so many hours, and they need some spiritual help, and they don't know where to turn. They're all from out of town, so they called their friend who lives in Wisconsin. He didn't know anybody either, but he knew of our temple in Chicago, so he looked us up, and he called. He said, can you go? Okay. So my wife and I, we went there. And the family from Hawaii is around their father. They're Buddhist. I wonder, I did the best I could. But as I think about this experience, there are many different skillful means or scenarios that I could, what would have been the best, because at one point, the son said something like, can you give us something that will help us, some prayer, or you have anything, you know, anything you could do to help us in this time, you know, if you could give us something. You know, I gave him some Dhammapada readings, but still, you know, so that they had something written. When you're in that kind of a situation, you need something offered to you, perhaps, something, you know. If there's something you could fall back upon, there was another situation where I'll come back to this example in a bit, but I just recalled another situation that a minister told me in Los Angeles, where there was a elderly couple. They were selling a Corvette car, and I guess they had put an ad in there, and I guess a couple of guys came to look at the car, and they thought, you know, whoever owns a Corvette must be rich. So they came in the guise of buying that car, and when they got access to the couple's apartment, they pulled the guns, and they started to burglarize the house. But in the meantime, to immobilize the couple, they put them on between their box spring and mattress in their bedroom, sandwiched in there. And after they tried to burglarize the house, they shot the couple through the mattress. The husband survived. The wife did not. And the husband was telling the minister later on, some, you know, years later, says, yeah, when this was happening, my wife was saying the Nembutsu, Namam Dabs, Namam Dabs. continually. And these two robbers, they didn't know what she was saying. She said, stop saying that, stop saying that. But she wouldn't stop saying it. Being a Shin Buddhist, Nembutsu recitation was the only thing she felt could fall back upon. Is this praying? Something that gave comfort. What is the function of prayer? Is it asking for something? Is it seeking comfort? Is it simply an expression that's coming from deep within a person? Whether it's some kind of a wish. I saw an old Shin Buddhist, American Buddhist service book. And it had one little section was called Thought Wave. And it was an invocation, benediction type of a passage. And it was titled A Thought Wave. Sending out a thought wave into the universe. This is my primal wish, and it comes from it's a individual's expression to the universe. But that's one way of putting it. So that's a nice topic, and those are the kinds of, I think, valuable things to discuss as in a multi-religious society. Well, today's guest is Muyo Ken Swanson, who lives in Whitefish Bay, Wisconsin, which is near Milwaukee. And he is a lay minister from our Bright Dawn class that was inducted in 2009. And he comes from a Zen tradition. He works in law enforcement. And as he has pointed out, if someone has to carry a gun, who better than a mindful Buddhist? I don't know what his Dharma glimpse is going to be today, but Muyo Sensei.
Good morning. All the regulars from when we're in our training class know about our ducks. We have about 18 every day that come here to eat and drink and relax on our front lawn for a few months. In a few weeks, they'll fly away. We don't know where they go from here, but we know that they'll return next spring, usually around the second week of March. It's a small miracle. We are up to about 40 pounds of cracked corn a week now. I really enjoy my chores. Washing out the koi bowl and changing the water twice a day, throwing out feed three times a day, and awakening to the calls from our roof when there's not enough food for the flock. We are all very mindful of the birds and beings that are also struggling in the Gulf of Mexico to survive the worst oil spill in this in this country by far. Every day, the stories seem to get worse. 40% of the wetlands in this country are in Louisiana, and they're all covered in oil. The largest seafood industry in the lower 48 states is there as well. People who live off the sea are suffering. We read about how even with all the cleaning and all the care, the pelicans are getting less than 10% of them will ever breed or live. Extinction is forever. It makes us sad. When I say us, I mean my wife and myself. It also makes us angry. I found something from Pure Water Project, which we have been part of, and I'd like to share it today in my Dharma talk. It's about eco-dharma. Eco-dharma means ensuring a better harmony between man and nature based on the understanding of interdependent origination. One of the fundamental teachings of Buddhism recognizes that nothing exists entirely by itself. when we see the law of cause and effect, or interdependence, it's clear that the pure positive values of respect, excuse me a minute, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to be coughing on you. The values of respect and responsibility are the best response to creating and sustaining long-term prosperity. And for the creation of the auspicious circumstances through which spiritual growth can mature and flourish. From a Buddhist perspective, nature and spirit are united, not divided. For Buddhists, nature is not static, but a living, dynamic, supporting thousands of beings. Many in our Sangha have been talking about prayer. It seems appropriate because it's a mean of invoking and maintaining a positive and even sacred relationship. Raising prayer flags for peace, wisdom, harmony, loving kindness, and compassion shows a commitment and a constant recognition of this truth. Equidharma is not so much about changing the world or about changing others like British Petroleum. It's more about changing oneself and how one relates to the world. Equidharma is about overcoming our egocentric habits. It's about being engaged in creating a positive environment around ourselves and being sensitive to others. It requires personal humility and confidence and goodness. Teach by example through kindness and gentleness, not aggression. Equidharma is not about being against anything or about protesting. If you are frustrated with the way things are, it's only because you wish things to be better. Just see what things are for what they are. If you are upset, be upset with action, not with the person. Equidharma is as much a journey of the heart as it is a journey of wisdom. Equidharma embraces the spirituality of us all and of a nature. Sustainability is a sacred practical support and a spiritual expression. Water is not just water. I have a capping phrase from the book Siddhartha. The river looked at Siddhartha with 1,000 eyes. It seemed to him that whoever understood this river and its secrets would understand much more. Many secrets and all secrets. In closing, my thought wave for the living beings of the Gulf of Mexico and for British Petroleum refers to Kuan Yin, the mother of the universe. And it goes like this. Within the sigh of the wind, the songs of nature, you will find her presence, watching, listening. She forgives you before you ask. May it be so. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Muyo Sensei. I'm always very impressed with Dharma glimpses that, they're always relevant to what's going on in current events and so forth. And indeed, we live in a time where the climate is a big topic, sustainability is a big topic, nature is a big topic. It is a time when Buddhists and Buddhism can step up and really make a contribution of emphasis coming from different terms are used, green dharma, echo dharma, or echo sanghas are being formed. The word green, the word sustainability, the word interdependency, if it has been mentioned that when you talk about the relationship between humans and nature, there used to be a stereotyped image of man conquering nature. You know, this was from pioneering days, and when the industrial complex took over and science and technology, you know, we started to live in concrete jungles. Maybe things have to get to a certain point where the downside we started to experience, and then we needed to redress the balance. How far do we go, you know, with science and technology? And it's not easy. You got a lot of big interests, lobbyists. You got, when you think about the Ken Burns National Parks documentary, America's best idea. We take national parks for granted, but that was a revolutionary idea. There are a lot of countries never thought of this idea of having a national park to preserve, you know, nature spots so that future generations. And there was a lot of fight about that when it was going on, and it was not legislated yet, because private interests said, hey, we need this for the benefit of people. We need private industry to come in. We need the natural resources there on the land. What do you mean just put it there for people to go on vacation? There was maybe for those vested interests, they didn't see the kind of benefit of maintaining the connection to that we're part of nature. And that kind of thing is going on today, whether the farmers need water, and then the environmentalists are saying, well, if your water management is like this, well, you're going to kill off a lot of, you know, fish species and all kind of wildlife habitat and this and that. So it's something that is being played out right now. And Buddhism can play a big part. I know that there's maybe over 30 years ago, some of the pioneers and Buddhists were raising this topic, you know, just like Rachel Carson did for ecology, you know, over 50 years ago. Nobody knew the word ecology in those days. And she was talking about the effect of toxics, chemicals being used. And I think our awareness is just starting to come out. And Buddhism, with its strong teaching of interdependency, and when you could see, you know, harmonizing with nature, not conquering nature. When you see traditional, say, Chinese landscape painting, you know, from the east, you see the sky, the clouds, the mountains, the river, and then you see a tiny little boat and a man there. You know, I mean, not only is just humans being part of nature, but not a dominant part. Harmonizing in the whole thing. And I think we were much closer to this psychologically when we were agricultural civilization. If you live out in the country, or if you garden a lot, or, you know, if you go out in nature a lot, you could sort of feel this primitive, primal connection. But if you're in a business world, or you don't get out much in nature, your priorities are just naturally, you know, stunted in this area. You have to be able to get out. You know, if Lake Michigan wasn't there for Chicago, boy, that would be a crazy place. If there wasn't parks around, if there wasn't trees and greenery around, of course, if you go to the other extreme of, you know, just physical chemistry, the atmosphere and what plants and, you know, how the whole ecosystem fits together for us to physically live, but even psychologically, it's crucial. And we need a lot of skillful spokesmen for these kind of things. I remember Reverend Don Castro, minister in Seattle, was one of these early, he said that green Dharma, or green Buddhism, is a redundancy. I mean, you know, for him, green is the Buddhist color, and the Buddha should be colored green. And he's pointing to the earth with one hand. You know, the earth is my witness. And he fought a lot of personal battles where, as a minister, when he was in California, some of the farmers who were a part of the congregation, they wanted to spray some of the temple grounds with something. And he had a couple of young children, and he was a green Dharmist. Green Buddhist, and he said, no, please don't spray. It's okay. You know, he really expressed his strong opinion about it. He said, okay, okay. So the board said, okay. But some member, you know, did spray from good intentions. And, you know, just didn't realize. Okay. And this really upset him. Sometimes that happens in church. Decisions made, but then a friend of another friend said, oh, didn't the thing get sprayed yet? You know, communication, whatever. Those kinds of experiences happen. There's a book called Mindfully Green by Stephanie Kaza, who's a professor back east. And we use that book in our curriculum. She's edited a book called Hooked in terms of, when we're consumers, can you consume mindfully? You know, as a paramita, as one of the paramitas, including, so to add to the list of generosity, right effort, vigorousness, patience, meditativeness, you might say consumerism. Take a breath. Is that enough? You always have to buy? Can you consume mindfully? Consuming might be the kind of mass media messages you always consume, or being influenced by advertising, the powerful, pervasive influence of salesmanship. It said, the topic of desire and greed, human desire and greed, okay, not just for food, but you want the best food, okay, and so forth. Not just shelter, but hey, a better house. Not just transportation, but my Mercedes Benz. We know that. Where's our happiness lie? Huh? Is there any limit to that kind of unsatiable, hungry ghost? These are topics. Okay. Straight consumerism. We use consumerism. They explore it, different articles in Buddhist literature now, from many angles. Sometimes people used to say philosophically, I think, therefore I am. You know, in the modern society, it's like, I buy, therefore I am. You know, people use shopping as therapy. You know, go see Dr. Neiman Marcus. He'll fix you up. Go to the Prasna Shopping Mall. And there was an article in today's paper about the pervasiveness of petrochemical industry. It said almost every product that you use has petrochemicals in it, if it's not a metal product, just like a piece of iron or steel. It's in your toothpaste, it's in paper, it's in plastic, it's in things that we eat and materials that we use, not just heating and fuel. But the petrochemical industry is, you know, we depend upon it quite a bit. So it's there's a tremendous struggle going on about our whole lifestyle, our whole way of being, not just, oh, we'll recycle and we're doing our part, or, you know, we'll use bicycles a little bit more. We want to look at ourselves at our very base of who we are as, you know, as a human being, just alive, and our lifestyle, you know, is a very basic thing. So I think this whole area is challenges us. And I appreciate the message. That's all for today's broadcast. Let's put our hands together in oneness and gratitude. I also thank our guest, Muyo Sensei, and I thank all of you for joining together today. Have a beautiful day.